Good afternoon. Welcome back. I hope you had an enjoyable break for lunch. And of course, as the exhibition is so very busy, I should like to remind you that it's always the evenings on both Saturday and Sunday that are actually probably the quietest moments at which to go into the exhibition. For now, though, the afternoon session. We're starting now with Christine Riding, who's the Tate curator on this exhibition, who will talk about curating GoGam. We have a short abstract in the program, so don't need to go into too much length about it. But suffice it to say that Christine has not just worked on curating the show, but has also carried out an absolutely incredible task of talking about the exhibition to countless people since the opening. And I really wanted to express a special warm thanks to her for being here as well and coming to us with such an interesting and carefully thought-out proposition about the history of representations of GoGam. Christine will be followed directly by Singaporean artist Ming Wong, whose presentation is called Island Boy. He has promised us a special presentation for this afternoon, and I think it will be a real delight. Then we will have our tea break, after which we round off the afternoon with a talk by Grayson Perry, followed by a panel discussion with all of us. Now, though, over to Christine Riding.
Thank you very much, Marco, and thank you to everyone here. I'm going to talk for about 25 minutes to half an hour, hopefully rather religiously, because we want to keep ahead of time, on the idea of curating exhibitions or displaying of exhibitions of Gauguin's work from the Manet and the Post-Impressionist exhibition, which opened on the 8th of November 1910, which means it's exactly 100 years when this exhibition actually opened. And from then onwards, a few comments about other exhibitions and ways that have been used to exhibit Gauguin to underline certain ideas about him as an artist up to the present exhibition at Tate Modern, but also about ideas around marketing and branding Gauguin, which was mentioned earlier on. So my three ideas that I'm going to explore here are around the words modern, cliché and reputation. Now, anyone that works at Tate Britain will know the power, and don't work at Tate Modern, will know the power of the word modern, certainly in terms of people's expectations and the energy and excitement that that word seems to generate in exhibition or gallery-going public. And I do want to explore that a little bit because it's very early on in Gauguin's posthumous career, even during his late lifetime, that he gets denoted very specifically as a modern artist. And as far as the British public's concerned, the exhibition that's always quoted in this context is the Manet and the Post-Impressionist exhibition, which was curated by the artist and art critic Roger Fry and opened at the Grafton Galleries, as I said, on November the 8th. It's famous because it caused an enormous furore. There were enormous amounts of articles that were published even the first month in November, over 50 in fact, in the British press. And there seems to have been howls mainly of abuse about the kind of art that was being exhibited and the sort of posturing around the term modern art that was being proposed by Roger Fry and others. To the extent that Gauguin's Tahitian women, for example, his representation of Tahitian women, were described by one critic as bizarre, morbid, and horrible. Now, there were about 37 Gauguins on display during this exhibition, and I'm focusing on him, of course, because he's the subject mainly of our talk. Obviously, there were other artists represented. But interestingly, although it's called Manet and the Post-Impressionist, it's actually a Gauguin painting on the poster, Poème Barbare, from the second trip to Tahiti by Gauguin. So he was very prominent in terms of the marketing of the exhibition as well as prominent in terms of the displays. And indeed, Spencer Gore actually says, as a British artist, Spencer Gore, and I quote, Of all the painters represented here, Gauguin seems to be the least disliked. He is certainly the best represented. So why is this exhibition so important in terms of the way that art historians have written about modern art in Britain in the 20th century? Well, rather interestingly, there seems to have been a sea change during the course of the two-month exhibition where people started to talk perhaps less rabidly or sort of in a lathered sense about modern art and seemed to be considering what was being proposed by Roger Fry and the artists that were being represented. To the extent that an anonymous critic in the Daily Graphic, and I quote, said, "During the first week or two of the exhibition, a considerable proportion of the spectators used to shout with laughter. But on Sunday, the general attitude was one of admiration and regret that an exhibition which has furnished so much food for discussion must close." And in fact, there seems to have been so much encouragement, shall I say, in terms of what happened at the end of this exhibition, in terms of it raising the idea of debate around the term modern art and modernism, that in the following year, there was another exhibition, this time focusing on Gauguin and Cézanne, which of course is a wonderful pairing, which was staged at the Stafford Gallery and seems to have had the involvement, or certainly one of the instigators, was Professor Michael Sadler, who was a historian and educationalist, who actually owned the three Gauguin paintings that you see here in this painting by Spencer Gore, Manao tu Papao, Christ in the Garden of Olives, and the Vision of the Sermon. I mean, three of the, if I can use this term, icons of Gauguin's oeuvre in the presence, and all three in the exhibition upstairs. And one of the commentators on the exhibition at this time, and it opened literally a year later in 1911 and closed in 1912, J.B. Manson said, and I quote, that the exhibition was a much-needed opportunity for the karma study of the two most interesting personalities in modern art. So again, this phrase, modern art, is immediately being attached to Gauguin. Now, Belinda Thompson has written in the catalogue, and it's obviously been spoken of much, how this notion of modern art, how Gauguin can sit rather uneasily with notions of modern art, especially if we fixate over ideas of abstraction, and particularly in terms of the present exhibition with its curatorial ambitions towards exploring narrative strategies, how modern art has often been described in terms of the rejection of narrative and subject towards pure, as it were, art for art's sake. And paintings like this that are in the Tate's own collection, are they sit rather uneasily in that kind of context. But nonetheless, moving forward into the 20th century, there seems to have been an acceptance that Gauguin was a modern artist, that he fitted into this context, and indeed, when the galleries were redisplayed in the 1920s with the opening of a sequence of new galleries that you can see going off what is now Gallery 9 in Tate Britain, they were actually called the Modern Foreign and Sargent Galleries. So again, this seems to have been sort of codified in the way that the Tate, as an institution, described the galleries and the contents within. And indeed, what's really interesting about this redisplay is the juxtaposition with the Turner Bequest, which everyone's surrounded by here, on what we would call picture gallery red, which is a traditional colour to show historic art on, that actually you can see down the corridor towards modern art, you have a different colour on the walls. You have this pale, beigey, champagne-y colour. In other words, historic and modern have been coded by colour, historic and modern. And that is where the Tate's Tahitian Pastoral for IAEA was actually exhibited. Now, what's really interesting as far as a curator is what actually happened to Turner. Because as you know, probably, in the way that Turner was appreciated after the Turner Bequest, the way that the works were actually exhibited was that Turner was increasingly perceived, and I can't go into this in any depth, as a kind of precursor to Impressionism, to Modernism, to ideas of abstraction, but only part of his oeuvre was understood in that sense. So Turner, rather interestingly, and I'm sorry that there's only one title on the screen, rather interestingly, gets divided up literally in the Tate's displays in the 1920s and 1930s as either historic Turner, as represented by Gallery 9. They redisplayed this adjoining gallery here to exhibit things like Norham Castle, from the 1840s, the aesthetic chiming in terms of what people perceived to be modern art, that is abstraction and the rejection or seemingly no subject or narrative content. So poor old Turner is both historic and contemporary. And that seems to be sort of built into the way that the Tate exhibited its historic and modern and contemporary collections throughout the 20th century, I would argue. For example, one of the exhibitions, the last big exhibition on Gauguin in London was in 1966 at the Tate Gallery in Millbank in the Devine Galleries, which were actually created to exhibit sculpture. And I'm fascinated by the design of this exhibition, given that the historic collection was still being hung on figured silks of rich colours, which seemed to denote, just by code, the fact that it was historic. So here we have Gauguin and the Pont-Aven Group, which was the exhibition title from 1966, in an exhibition space which seems to be unashamedly modern, and even rather helpfully flanked by a Barbara Hepworth and a Henry Moore either side, to denote perhaps the modernity of the contents within. And we see the predominance, of course, of white, a very pared-down aesthetic, very bold, very modern, and these black leather and chrome seats, which we still use at the Tate even today, again noting the kind of clean lines that one would express, the freshness, if you like, of the idea of the modern. And I'm really fascinated by the fact that we actually do, you know, we have some paintings in the exhibition upstairs or have been exhibited around the world in different contexts, how the wall colour or the environment can change one's perception of a painting as to whether it's historic or modern or contemporary. Indeed, one classic example, which actually was much derided in the American press, was the Museum of Modern Art in New York reframing all its historic collection, that is, paintings from the 19th century, taking them out of their rather florid, as they would have seen it, carved, gilded frames into plain, dark frames in order to underline the modern in this modern art. It was very controversial, and if you want to see the results, there are two paintings in the exhibition from MoMA with those dark brown frames. So obviously, to be modern, there is a problem with being also at once historic. And this whole thing, I think, was kind of played out rather interestingly in a recent exhibition that was staged at the Cleveland Museum of Art, which then moved on to the Van Gogh exhibition museum in Amsterdam. And the exhibition was actually on the Volpini exhibition, Café Volpini, which has been much mentioned this morning. And it is very interesting just to see how the exhibition curators and designers staged the exhibition in Cleveland itself, where they were clearly very keen to focus on the idea of Paul Gauguin, Paris, 1889, as underlined by the title. In other words, it was artist, time, and space specific. It was historic. And in order to underline that flavour, that idea of going back in time almost, to get a sense of what it was like to go to the Café Volpini, and this was stated in their press release, that they had actually sort of redisplayed, got a sense of the intimacy of café society in Paris at that time. Even the shop had this kind of sort of celebratory, sort of universal exhibition flavour to it. And there was a kind of interactive quality, as if you yourself were a patron, potentially, or certainly a spectator of the 1889 Volpini exhibition. You could actually go around and pick up facsimiles of Gauguin's famous suite with the original sitting on the wall. And this sort of wonderful striped wallpaper with this kind of dado line, sort of historicising the context of this modern art. Now, what fascinated me, given that they were so place and time specific in Cleveland, is that when the exhibition moved on to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, they got rid of Paul Gauguin, Paris, 1889, to include the subtitle, The Breakthrough into Modernity. No longer place and time specific, but this open onward march towards what we all glorify, that is modern art. It was a fascinating switch, and one that I understand from Belinda this morning, they have come to regret having changed the title. And they used it on their advertising. In other words, this face of Gauguin, this self-portrait that we've come to know so well from this morning, plastered with this breakthrough to modernity message, branding Gauguin yet again as a modern artist. And if you aren't branded modern, what are you? If you were a contemporary of Gauguin, it must be fairly scary if you're sitting on your cloud nine looking down thinking, what's happened to my reputation? So it's really interesting the way that I think that people do get classified. I think very early on, certainly in Gauguin's case, and interestingly what happened to Turner, in terms of this idea of the modern. And rather interestingly, a similar thing actually did happen at Tate Modern, slightly differently, but I think rather powerfully, in the sense that the curatorial ambition of the exhibition was embedded in the subtitle Maker of Myth, Gauguin, Maker of Myth, which was actually is still on the front cover of the catalogue. But in all the advertising for the exhibition, all you get is Gauguin. And that's because the advertising team here, rather interestingly, did not want the message, the marketing message of the exhibition to be watered down by a sort of curatorial premise that could be interpreted as being a part of Gauguin rather than the full Gauguin. What they wanted to promote was the idea of a full-blown, all-singing, all-dancing retrospective on Gauguin. But if we called it Maker of Myth, it might suggest that we're only showing part of what Gauguin had done, or that there was a spin that meant that it wouldn't be the retrospective as promised. So this actually, the Maker of Myth title, as far as the exhibition's concerned, only appears at the entrance to the exhibition itself. In every other context, all you will see is the word Gauguin. Now, we've seen this image before, but I wanted to just flag it up again because I think it's a very powerful juxtaposition of a title of a book with a self-portrait of a particular artist and how the title and the image mapped over each other play off each other and build a certain idea, certain messages, whether it be about Gauguin himself or our understanding perhaps of Joseph Conrad's novella. But even if you didn't know anything about Conrad or indeed Gauguin, I think The Heart of Darkness is a rather wonderful, powerful idea about how to interpret, if one then discovered this was Gauguin, what exactly Gauguin was like. So what I'm moving on to here really is reputation and the way that Gauguin has been branded. I did a real big sweep of books on Gauguin, in other words, the full unadulterated Gauguin. And more often than not, perhaps unsurprisingly, and I use that word sort of advisedly, perhaps unsurprisingly, Gauguin is mapped over an image of Tahitian women or Tahitian girls. And that seems to be the expectation. If you're doing an overview of Gauguin's life, the cliche or the inevitability of utilizing an image of a Tahitian subject, in particular Tahitian female subject, is almost unassailable. And indeed, this painting, which is entitled When Will You Marry? From the Kunstmuseum in Basel, was actually the front runner for the marketing campaign for the Gauguin exhibition until the loan was declined, and then it fell off its perch. But nonetheless, it underlines the power of this kind of image associated with the word Gauguin that was seen to be strangely inevitable. Now, what came into play after that painting fell off its perch in terms of loan with these two paintings, the one on the left, Where Are You Going from the Hermitage, and the one on the right, Two Tahitian Women from the Metropolitan Museum in New York. Now, the one on the left we couldn't use because it hadn't been agreed by the time the marketing campaign had to be finalised, and the one on the right, rather interestingly, because if it appeared on the underground, the London Underground, there is some censorship involved in the images that you can have. You can have male nipples, but you can't have female nipples. So we had proposed to the Metropolitan that Gauguin would actually be positioned across here, but they felt that we were unnecessarily censoring the image, and we said it's not us, it's the London Underground, and they said we don't care, you're not doing it. So they fell by the wayside as well. In the interim, I, with more hope than expectation, offered up another sequence of images that I was hoping was going to slightly buck that idea of the cliche. The marketing team said to me, if you stop anyone in the street and if they've heard of Gauguin, you said to them, what do you know about this guy? They'd say, oh, he's that bloke that went to Tahiti. There was this kind of inevitability about Tahiti being used to market the exhibition. And in some senses, because it was so inevitable, is why I was very keen to use the Maker of Myth, because I felt that an unmediated image of Tahitian women with Gauguin in the public domain could be quite problematic. So I offered up something that I thought, albeit these are icons, if I'm allowed to use that term again, icons of Gauguin's oeuvre, I offered up these two as very powerful images that would strike the viewer when they came onto the underground or saw it passing on a bus. This was the kind of image I felt that would really hold people's attention, but it just simply wasn't Tahiti and therefore was thrown out. And I was reminded, and sorry about the image on the night, that actually Belinda, our own lead curator on the exhibition, had actually curated an exhibition at the National Galleries of Scotland in 2005, which focused on the vision of the sermon, and they had used it in their advertising, of course, and on the front cover of the catalogue. And the Yellow Christ, I just don't know, that was never really discussed in terms of being a viable marketing image. So here we are then with the finalised design of the marketing image for Gauguin, the inevitability of it being a Tahitian subject, but I have to confess that it was me that put forward the idea of Nevermore Tahiti as the poster image. I was, by this juncture, I think, fairly crushed by the idea of ever getting anything other than a Tahitian image on the poster, but I also felt that with the curatorial ambitions of the exhibition, the subtitle Maker of Myth, that Nevermore was as powerful as anything else, frankly, in the exhibition in terms of setting forward the ideas that we had in terms of the intellectual ambitions of the show. I mean, obviously, it's an extremely well-known painting by Gauguin. There's no doubt about it. It has this amazing artistic complexity and ambiguity and also astonishing narrative context and strategy, which again underlines exactly what we wanted to do with the exhibition. And of course, rather wonderfully, it has the title written on the canvas. And we've devoted a whole gallery to the idea of titles written on canvases and exploring what Gauguin meant by that particular idea. And indeed, the painting itself, Nevermore, is in that gallery. And the title relates, of course, to Edgar Allan Poe, underlining Gauguin's continual interest in literary references and powerful references that would have resonated with people in his own time. So in that sense, it was a very obvious, wonderful, powerful marketing image. But I go back to my original idea about whether or not one would have wanted necessarily to have gone down the cliché route in the image that one would have selected. Because actually, what the exhibition is really trying to say under the umbrella of Maker of Myth, is that one can approach these paintings in exactly the same way, almost irrespective of time and place in terms of what Gauguin was doing. Now, my slight resistance or reservation about using a Tahitian image was also about the reputation and the cliché of Gauguin that has been handed down literally from the time that he died, maybe even up to the present time. Certainly not amongst people that know Gauguin's work and know the scholarship, but maybe to a broader, more general audience. And of course, the exhibition poster is addressing all audiences and all experiences of Gauguin himself. I had in mind, of course, I mean, I remember seeing this, the film on the left-hand side, Moon and Sixpence, when I was little. And it, of course, is after the Somerset Maugham novel, Moon and Sixpence, which was published in 1919. That's not that long after Gauguin's death in 1903. And interestingly, played off an idea of Gauguin, which was very current at that time, sort of fed into by Victor Segalin and others, of a rather egotistical, monstrous character, the monstrous, horrible Gauguin, the person that abandons his wife and children in order to pursue this sort of hedonistic and selfish destiny, as he sees it or likes to frame it, as an artist in the South Seas. And Somerset Maugham, of course, actually changes the character quite significantly, but perhaps rather powerfully, because, of course, it is a satirical novel, changes him to a character called Charles Strickland, who is an Englishman, who is a London stockbroker, who abandons his children and his wife and goes off to Tahiti to fulfill his destiny as an artist, as a man of genius, as we heard earlier on today. And it was in the film version, it was actually played by George Sanders, who's this wonderful louche character. I mean, practically every film I've ever seen him in, he's playing the cad and the bounder, and he doesn't disappoint in this particular movie. There's a very louche way of speaking, which is rather wonderful. And of course, we have the prone, beautiful female across the top, and then these rather wonderful strap lines that they put in on the various posters for the film, "Women are strange little beasts." And the fact that it is obviously being associated with Gauguin into the present is the fact that The Moon and Sixpence as a novel is often reproduced with images by Gauguin on the front cover. So there is that connection undoubtedly being made. We've already had mentioned the Lust for Life film, which came out in 1956, with Kirk Douglas as Vincent van Gogh, and that juxtaposes a sort of serious artist over here on the right-hand side with this rather sort of, you know, laughing like a drain Anthony Quinn leaning on a bar, drinking again. It's sort of, but it's a very high-octane, testosterone-led representation of Gauguin by Anthony Quinn. It's a very powerful performance, just over 20 minutes long, and he won an Oscar for that performance. And unfortunately, Kirk Douglas didn't get anything for his performance as Van Gogh. But nonetheless, there is this wonderful scene in the film where Gauguin and Van Gogh are sitting by a riverside, and he's talking, Gauguin's talking about his sacrifice in becoming an artist, and then rather wistfully looks across at a mother and two children sitting by the riverside as an allusion to his abandonment, as it were, of his family. And then more recently, the 1986 film The Wolf at the Door, starring Donald Sutherland, portraying Gauguin after his return to Paris from his first trip to Tahiti in 1893. And I think one needs to just leave it at that in terms of what this poster was projecting in terms of Gauguin's life and his art. And I suppose at this juncture, one should ask how much curators and institutions should take notice of the history of an artist, their biography, let alone the art they produce, when they're presenting exhibitions in the 21st century. And I'll come onto that in just a moment. Indeed, we were... I remember when we were dividing the Q&As, question and answers that we do for the press when we did the press launch, but also when the exhibition was launched in September, wondering exactly how much focus the British press would have on this reputation that Gauguin has for, by our standards, having relationships with underage girls. And again, my concern perhaps in using such an image to promote the exhibition in London in the 21st century. And indeed, the only adverse, I mean, that's actually in its sense ironic anyway, adverse comment about the idea of Gauguin in any sense as a paedophile came from Private Eye with this wonderful title, "Paedophile Sex Tourist Was Artist Scam," written by our gallery staff, Jacques Tahiti Modern and Polynesia, one of their finest sort of titles, I think. And written in the text, it says, "In a sensational new exhibition of the renowned pervert Paul Gauguin, curators are trying to claim that the notorious sex fiend was secretly a talented painter with a gift for vibrant colours." And it's continued on page 94. So I think it was certainly something that we bore in mind and something that one should bear in mind, but actually rather like with the more recent discussions after Fiona McCarthy's biography of Eric Gill and all the comments in and around that, that it is an interesting conundrum about what exactly one takes on board in terms of what an artist does in their private life or their public career as opposed to what they do on the canvas or out of the kiln. It's quite an interesting question. So just to finish, I'll just talk very generally then about how certain things were addressed within the exhibition. Idea of modernity. I was told recently that had Vicente Todoli actually continued as Tate Modern's director into the period of the Gauguin project, it would have been white walls in the exhibition, which was I was quite fascinated by. I didn't go for a colour scheme that I thought would denote him as modern or relevant to the contemporary world. And sometimes I do wonder how far down the route we can keep asking historic artists to talk to the present. A good friend of mine, the art historian Sam Smiles, actually once said to me, "Can't the past be a strange and distant land? Isn't it its strangeness that is interesting? Why does it have to be given a contemporary spin or context in order to be relevant or pull out its relevance?" And I have some sympathy with that idea that art, historic art, can be historic and unfamiliar. I chose these beige colours in the exhibition in order to give the, because Gauguin's paintings are so vibrant and bright and various in style, to actually, in some senses, lock them together, to give them a kind of neutral context. I wasn't looking for modernity, I wanted neutrality in order to exhibit the works. And equally in the documentary sections, the two life and time sections that we have a blue colour, which actually, in as whether one, I don't know if any of the visitors actually understood this, but we chose blue in order to underline the idea of the sea and voyage and travel. But it's also a colour that comes into play in Gauguin's work. And it's in the life and time section that I think we do address the context of Gauguin's life, his misdemeanors, his transgressions. We give it a context. We underline what society was like, what its expectations were, what artists did, what Gauguin wrote, the kind of places he went to, in order to underline where his art is coming from. And we felt that actually putting it in life and time section that people could go into or not was the appropriate way to do it, rather than overburden the main exhibition, perhaps, with too much interpretation, which is certainly not the Tate modern way. Certainly interpretation on the whole in exhibitions is quite pared down. We also wanted, from the very beginning, hence why the first gallery has the self-portraits in it, to underline the premise of the exhibition is not just about narrative strategies generally, but also about Gauguin's identity and self-mythologizing. That would be in people's minds literally from the word go, so that they could see the familiar self-portraits that we've seen often this morning, as well as the less familiar, literally in sequence, one after the other, to see a development, perhaps, or a change or diversity in identity that Gauguin projected into the spectator's realm, but also to think about the way that Manao Tu Papao, which of course is the first painting you see when you come into the exhibition, and the reason why we did that was because it's a very famous painting, but also Rather Like Nevermore is a very layered, very powerful one, which underlines the main themes of the exhibition. And we felt that in the context of the self-portraits and self-mythology, especially with the self-portrait itself, with Manao Tu Papao in the background, that was a very powerful context to put this painting in. And also encouraging people to think about self-mythology, then you would go into the exhibition and you would see works of art where Gauguin had actually put his own features or his alter egos or played around with his identity throughout the exhibition rather than just zoning it in the first gallery. So you have to get to gallery 6 before you find Christ in the Garden of Olives in the sacred theme section, and the self-portrait in the form of a vase is in gallery 2. In the gallery named Making the Familiar Strange. And equally, you have to get to gallery 8 to see the Teller of Tales gallery in order to see the caricature that Belinda showed us earlier on. So just finally, just very briefly, in terms of dealing with the T word, as we call it, Tahiti, in the exhibition, is not to mark it out in some senses as different or a break with the past, but actually to underline the continuity in Gauguin's approach, his strategies that can actually be linked from one moment to the next by bringing together works that are perhaps Christian narratives, for example, these ones here, the Yellow Christ and the Green Christ here, with Tahitian sacred subject matter. That's one of the MoMA paintings, by the way, in the dark frame there, the moon and the earth, and then we have the words of the devil, and then Sacred Mountain, and also examples of Gauguin's tiki. So in other words, we bring those works together, those themes together, to underline that continuity of interest in religious subject matter, no matter where it came from. And equally, just to finish, we wanted to point out, by very powerful juxtapositions, the kind of figures, themes, tropes that Gauguin throws up again and again. In particular, this figure of Aviri, the savage, this wonderful sculpture from the Musée d'Orsay, which appears in various guises in the exhibition. For example, in The Eternal Feminine, we actually group the painting with the sculpture and also works on paper to underline the various media through which this particular very powerful alter ego for Gauguin manifested itself. And finally, what does one do with the T word, the Tahitian subject matters? By any valuation, this is a wonderful sequence of Tahitian subject paintings, female subject paintings from the first period of Gauguin's existence, but seen through the very powerful lens, we think, of the idea of Gauguin's titles, because each of these paintings has the title written in Tahitian very deliberately on the canvas. So we explore here what the strategy was behind that. So I just want to finish on a quote by Roger Fry, if I can find it, where he wrote this in 1918, where after having positioned Gauguin so clearly as a modern artist, i.e. someone who was interested in abstraction, and or someone who seemed to be denoting abstraction and the idea of negation of narrative, he seems himself to have understood that actually Gauguin didn't quite fit. And indeed, in response to Gauguin's very famous painting, Du Vin en Nu, which unfortunately could not come to the exhibition, it's at the MFA in Boston, he had this to say, and then sort of recognised the very powerful, ambitious philosophical themes that Gauguin was exploring in the painting, and in some senses underlines exactly what we're trying to do with the exhibition. And I quote, "The extraordinary thing is that this intensely self-conscious and intellectual Frenchman did manage to create an art which fused perfectly the naivety of savage art with the most accomplished European tradition." In other words, Gauguin's work was anchored as much in the past as it was in the idea of difference. But he then sort of warmed to his theme and concluded that, in fact, he was right from the start, that Gauguin was a modern artist as he understood the term. And I quote, "But fortunately, he never forgot the limitations of pictorial art, so that in the great composition here in question, we are really not in the least concerned with the meaning of the symbolism. Au contraire." Thank you very much.
Over now to the second presentation of the afternoon, by artist Ming Wong.
Hello there. So who is Ming Wong? Who is this artist, Ming Wong? As an artist, I spend most of my time making art, obviously. I don't spend a lot of time in academic symposiums like today. But I thought I would like to offer myself for the next half an hour as a case study. All right? Now, in the last few years, I've developed a body of work where I have done reinterpretations of scenes, classic scenes from world cinema or national cinema. And I very often play all the roles myself, or I would miscast another actor. And this would involve having to play a role in a foreign language, in the wrong gender, in the wrong age, being of the wrong nationality, etc., etc., trying to be the complete opposite of what he or she can be. I would like first to explain, maybe, how I came to be doing what I'm doing. And to do this, I would take you on a journey back to the South Seas. Because I was born in the South Seas. I was born in Singapore. And the South Seas in question is the South China Sea. And the heart of the South Seas, or Nanyang, which is Chinese for South Seas, the heart of that is the Malay archipelago, which includes Singapore, and part of the Indonesian archipelago, including Java and Bali. Now, my grandparents migrated from China to Singapore less than 100 years ago. They were part of a big wave of migration from China down to Nanyang, to the South Seas. And amongst this group of immigrants, there were quite a few artists. And these artists set up the oldest art academy in Southeast Asia. It's called the Nanyang Academy of Fine Arts. And I did go to the Nanyang Academy when I was growing up in Singapore. And I'd like to start with today's lecture by showing you some examples of what these Nanyang artists did, what some of these South Seas artists did. Okay. It might look slightly familiar. I'll stop it there. What happened was these artists from China came down to Nanyang, and they traveled around the region, and they incorporated motifs that they encountered. The flora and fauna, and the landscape, cultures, myths of the local indigenous cultures. And they also very often went to, most of them have stayed in Europe. So quite a few of them have been to Paris. And when they came back to Singapore, they incorporated what they had learned, what they have influences from the Paris School of Art, with their own traditional training in Chinese art, with local motifs, such as palm trees, native women, and together they developed what is now called the Nanyang School of Art, the Nanyang School of Painting and Sculpture. Okay. Now, this was about the 1950s, and they all went to places like Bali and Java and encountered these native cultures and incorporated that in the art. And so I was trained in this academy, but of course I was a child of the 70s. And I grew up in the 70s in Singapore, a newly independent Singapore, which was struggling to find its own feet and to find its own identity. And what does it mean to be growing up in post-colonial Singapore in the 70s? I grew up listening to the BBC World Service. I watched a lot of bad TV from America, a lot of bad sitcoms, I'm sorry to say that. Also Bollywood movies and Hong Kong melodramas and kung fu movies, and as well as made in Singapore Malay movies. Now, there are four official languages in Singapore, namely English, Chinese, Malay, and Tamil, which reflected the makeup of the population. And my source of inspiration came from the cinema. So what I've done is I started looking at national cinema and finding out what it is that informed these artists, these filmmakers, to create these films. What was it about a time when they were making films for a specific community who spoke a specific language? And I decided that in my early days when I was trying to find out who I was, I experimented with becoming all these different, trying to find out who I was, and being influenced by all these films that I grew up with. Now, I went to London. I came to London in 1997 to do my postgraduate studies, and that's when I first started working with fine art media. And I lived in London for 10 years, after which I then moved to Berlin about 3 years ago, where I am now based. And traveled a lot in the interim years. And whenever I traveled to a new country, I would look at that particular national cinema, and I would then make a new work. I would try and insert myself in these movies, which required me to speak a different language and be a totally different person from who I am. Now I'm going to show you some clips of my work, and it's moving image work and it's video work, and it's quite challenging to show clips of works in a talk for half an hour. So I'm just going to show you a selection of personalities, of alter egos, of doppelgangers, of different personas that I've tried to become. I'm going to show you four examples. The first one is reinterpretations of films that were made in Singapore in the 50s and 60s. The national language at the time was Malay, so the films were in a Malay language, and the performers were all Malay Muslim actors from the theater. The producers were Chinese because they monopolized the filmmaking and distribution industry. And they went to the nearest film industry to get film directors and cameramen, namely India, to Bollywood. So there was there's a body of work, a body of films made in Singapore, produced by Chinese, directed by Indians, and performed by Malay Muslims. And these films are slowly disappearing from public memory. And on my first visit back to Singapore, since I moved to London, I decided to unearth these cinematic treasures and bring it back to life. In Singapore, well, in the Malay archipelago before the arrival of the British. So it was a historical epic drama set before the arrival of the British, which is quite unusual. There's also quite modern, there were quite controversial, now deemed controversial scenes where you had Malay Muslim women bearing their cleavage. And today you'll be hard pressed to see this on TV in Malaysia, for example, because most of the Malay Muslim women would be wearing headscarves and wearing loose Arabic-style dresses. And scenes of people drinking alcohol or dancing in the bikinis on the beach, a lot of these have been censored or simply not shown anymore. Hence, I thought it was important to unearth some of these movies because they have become iconic in for the Malay population. A lot of the lines and have become quotations in the everyday conversations. Unfortunately, the younger generations don't have access to most of this material anymore. And I also did this because in watching these films through the eyes of my Malay Muslim friends, they told me that because I was Chinese and a Singaporean, I could get away with it. But them being Malay Muslim, if they had done something with this, they could have gotten into trouble with the Muslim authorities and had their funding cut, for example. And the next work is a Fassbinder work, which I did when I first moved to Berlin, when I didn't speak any German. And I found myself in Kreuzberg in Berlin, which is home to the biggest Turkish population in Germany. And so I decided to do something with this remarkable film by Fassbinder called Ali Fear Eats the Soul, a story about a guest worker from Morocco who meets and falls in love with a German cleaning lady and how the whole world around them changes when they get married. I am part of a new wave of guest workers in Berlin today, the art guest workers, because Berlin is not a mecca for artists. And also, it's a response to how things haven't changed very much in Germany since 1974. And I'm playing all the roles, not just Ali, but I play Emmy and all the German characters. So it's not just Ali who speaks broken German. It's everybody who speaks bad German. And last year, I spent quite a bit of time in Italy because I was... I represented Singapore at the Venice Biennale, and I stayed on to make two other projects inspired by Italian cinema. The first one of which is Pasolini's film Teorema, about an Italian family who gets visited by a divine figure who seduces every member of the household and then suddenly leaves, which triggers an identity crisis in each and every member of the household. And they each embark on their own journey of self-discovery after they had to, leave what they thought of themselves behind. And I shot this on location. It was the first time I did location shooting in Naples, because Naples somehow has the concentration of all the problems of modern Italy. And the locations became a kind of co-actor. So I'm playing all these archetypal Italian characters, the imposter, set against the real space, and the landscape was kind of like an alter ego in a sense. And something on Death in Venice, which was my own reaction to my participation in the Venice Biennale, and also just a reflection of my own aging and of my own position in my career as a mid-career artist in crisis, like von Aschenbach, who has to go to Venice Well, I'll just show it. It was shot in Venice during the Venice Biennale, and it goes through lots of different national pavilions. And just one last thing. So now here I am at the Tate Modern, speaking to an audience in conjunction with the Gauguin exhibition. And I thought the only way to deal with this is to make something. So I have, just especially for you today. And that's, I'm gonna show this to you. It's the last thing for my talk.
All I can say is, no wonder Ming didn't tell me what his presentation was going to be. We've got 25 minutes now for a tea break. It's just next door in the Estelle Auditorium foyer. And please come back at 4 o'clock.
Thank you.